Take our Bibles and turn to Exodus chapter 14 this morning. Exodus chapter 14. Now let me give you the setting first. What I want to read. The Israelites had at this point been sojourning in Israel for over 400 years, with the biggest part of that time being spent in Egyptian bondage. Exodus 2 verses 23 through 25 states this. It says, "Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. As a result, God then called Moses to be their deliverer, and through Moses, God provided a number of miracles in the process of securing the Israelites' release." So in other words, just prior to what I'm going to be reading here in a little bit, the Israelites witnessed 10 divine, spectacular exploits at the hand of God. Now, Californians may think that they really saw something this last year with their earthquakes, floods, and fires. Well, I'll guarantee you that what they saw does not hold a candle to what the Egyptians experienced and what the Israelites witnessed. Now, normally, we take those 10 plagues that took place there in the book of Exodus for granted, and for probably a couple reasons. One, we've been told the story of the 10 plagues since we were little tykes over and over again. And secondly, and probably most importantly, we take them for granted because we personally did not experience them. But I want you this morning to try your best to imagine what the Israelites witnessed at that time. First, imagine turning on your faucet, flushing the toilet, turning on your sprinkler, standing in your shower, and all you get is rich, thick, red blood. Second, imagine climbing into bed, opening your refrigerator, putting on your socks or your shoes, and finding riveting, chirping, croaking, slippery, slimy frogs everywhere. Third, imagine every time the wind cranks up and begins to blow that every particle of dust that we're so used to here in the plains of Nebraska, that every particle of dust turns into a little blood-sucking lice infesting both man and beast alike. Lice which turn into tapeworms if swallowed. Fourth, imagine swarms of flies, gnats, and mosquitoes, so numerous, so pervasive, there's nowhere you can go to get away from them. So thick, you can't breathe without sucking some down your throat. Fifth, imagine walking out into the barnyard and finding 9 out of 10 of every animal on the place either dead or dying. And the same is found to be true in every other place in the country as well. Sixth, imagine rancid, pus oozing, stinking boils on every man, woman, and child, and every beast that's left, from their feet to the crown of their head, of the same kind that tormented Job. Seventh, imagine looking out your windows and witnessing your neighbors and their animals being pummeled to death by a hailstorm so severe that it kills everything in its path. Eighth, imagine locusts so numerous when flying they blot out the sun, so numerous you're unable to see any bare ground, so numerous the ground appears as if it's even alive, so numerous there is not a green plant, leaf, or blade of grass left in the land as far as you can see. Ninth, imagine 3 days of darkness with no sun, moon, or artificial light. So dark, the darkness can be felt. So dark that wherever you were when it came, in the field, in town, on the highway, in a boat, on the river, no matter where you were, wherever you were, you stayed put right there for 3 days and 3 nights, for 72 hours, not knowing during the time whether you'd ever see light again. All of that, and then culminated with the slaughter of every firstborn man and boy in your community. What a performance. What a production God put on. And just imagine if you were there to witness it all. But why? Why did God do it? Well, somebody's going to say, well, he did it to deliver his people. But God didn't have to do all of that to deliver the Israelites. He could have, in the very onset, wiped out all the Egyptians right off the bat. He could have used one angel in one night to have done it. So why? Well, Romans 9 and verse 17, quoting one of the verses from Exodus, puts it this way. It says, "For the Scripture says to Pharaoh, 'For this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth.'" Two reasons. First, to demonstrate his power. And secondly, that his name might be spread across the whole land. Yet even with that spectacular exhibition of God's power, nearly all of it was for naught. Turn to Psalms chapter 78. Hold your place in Exodus 14. And turn to Psalms 78. Psalm 78 and verses 41 through 43, it says, And again and again they tempted God and pained the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the adversary, when he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the field of Zoan. Notice it says, and they did not remember his power. And from those following verses, go over those same 10 plagues, his power that he performed in Egypt. But it says they didn't. Over and over again, they rebelled against him. Why? Because they didn't remember his power. Well, how soon did they forget? In about a week. Not as long as it took for the Egyptians to bury their dead and to pursue them to the Red Sea, which now brings us to the point of what I want to read in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14, I want to read verses 5 through 12. And there we find this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled Pharaoh and his servants, and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, "What is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. And he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And Yahweh hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out bodily. Boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them by camping by the sea beside Pihahiroth in front of Baal-zephon. And as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to Yahweh. And then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt?" Isn't it interesting? They cry out to Yahweh. But how long did they wait for an answer? Did they even bother to listen to see if there could even be an answer? No. Verse 11 again, it says, "Then they said to Moses, 'Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt?'" Verse 12, it says, "Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." You know, we think Bertrand Russell was the one who coined the phrase, "better red than dead," and that may be so. However, let me guarantee you, the idea was around for a whole lot longer than the time of Bertrand Russell. Because our forefathers were here at this event crying out, "better Egyptian than extinction." Not any different. And better red than dead. Same thing. Now, we're amazed at how in the world their memories could be short. But let me tell you, it wasn't their memories which was the problem. It was their mindset. Now, note, this wasn't the first time that they cried this out. Look at verse 12, and it certainly wasn't the last either. But look at verse 12 again. It says, "Isn't this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'?" Well, where was it previously said? Turn back to Exodus chapter 6. Exodus 6 and verse 9. It says, "So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage." They weren't about to listen to Moses at that point. Now, this is immediately following Pharaoh, this point in Exodus 6, is immediately following Pharaoh having increased their workload, but still demanding from them the same daily quotas. Now, as a result, they were telling Moses, again, "Leave us alone. We're better off in slavery than listening to your promises of freedom." Now, I don't know about you, but I can understand their response. After all, at this stage, how did they know that this God named Yahweh was any different than any of the other gods? You know, at this point, the priest of the Egyptians' gods had replicated everything that Moses and Aaron had done. And it sure hadn't brought deliverance, but it only worsened their bondage. We've got to be a little bit understanding. But how in the world could they be saying the exact same thing after witnessing God's mighty hand at work and after they were delivered after the slaughter of the firstborn? Surely we wouldn't do the same. Well, don't be so cocksure, because it all depends on our mindset as well. You know, we are provided some insights as to why the Israelites responded as they did in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 9. Again, it says, "So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage." Two reasons: despondency and cruel bondage. Now, I want you to note how those two things go together. Sure, it makes sense that they would despair under harsh slavery. That makes sense. Yet yet those two things fit together for other reasons as well. If you have the New American Standard Version, note how despondency is footnoted. It says in mine over in the right-hand column, it says, literally, shortness of spirit. Kind of an interesting way to look at despondency. Shortness of spirit. Well, could it be talking here about a shortage of God's spirit? Yeah, I think so. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 17. Second Corinthians 3, verse 17, it says, "Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." Now, the opposite would be just as true then. Where the Spirit of the Lord is not, there would be bondage or slavery. In other words, wherever there is bondage, spiritual, physical, political, economic, etc., the Spirit of the Lord is absent. Think of our prison systems. Isn't that slavery? Isn't that the result? Don't we have a prison system in the world today because the Spirit of the Lord is absent? Keeping in mind that Paul very clearly says that the law is spiritual, God's law made no room for even a prison system. We've got slavery of those men. Why? Because the Spirit of the Lord is absent in that situation. I threw that in as extra. But with that in mind, I think it would be also a pretty safe bet to say that the Spirit of the Lord is absent in Washington, D.C. as well, just as it was in the land of Egypt in that day. Those bureaucrats and politicians are producing more and more bondage, not more and more freedom. And if that's the case, then you can know, not that I need to tell you it, but you can know that the Spirit of the Lord is pretty much absent in Washington, D.C. So the absence of God's Spirit results in bondage or slavery. Now, it's understandable that the Israelites, that while the Israelites were physically enslaved, that they responded to Moses as they did. However, why would they respond to Moses in the same fashion after being miraculously delivered and physically freed? Back in Exodus 6, you can understand. The bondage had just gotten worse. But in Exodus chapter 14, verse 12, they had been set free by some of the most miraculous things that have ever happened on the face of this earth. So why would they respond the same then? Well, because they were still mentally enslaved. They still had the spirit of slavery leading to fear again. And isn't that what they did? They feared. They prayed to God that God had delivered them. But their spirit hadn't changed. And so they immediately feared again. And immediately cried out the same thing. You know, when the term slavery is used today, we've been conditioned as a people to automatically think of one type of slavery. Southern Negro slavery. You hear the word slavery, that's what you automatically think of. Yet there's more than one kind of slavery. There's actually two kinds. And for this message, I've never seen this before, but Revelation 18, John in the book of Revelation, in chapter 18, points out the two different types of slavery. Revelation 18, it's dealing with Babylon, actually Babylon's destruction. And in a part of the dialogue concerning her destruction, starting with verse 9 through 13, we find these words. Verse 9, and the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her, Mystery Babylon, will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, Woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. Now, doesn't that strike you as a little bit strange to say slaves and human lives? The King James probably renders it a little bit better. Matter of fact, it's footnoted the same in my side column again. The King James says slaves and souls of men. All of a sudden, we're seeing maybe a distinction. And the New King James Version makes the distinction even clearer because it says bodies and souls of men. There's two types of slavery. What's the difference? Well, first, there's forced slavery. That is, one who's bodily in bondage, yet free in mind and spirit. That'd be the first kind. The ones who were forced into slavery, where the Babylon didn't yet have their mind and heart and spirit. You might keep this in mind, too. Now, everybody's talking about the number of the beast, number of the Antichrist, being 666, and taking the number, and it means this, and it means that, and it meant this in the past, or it may mean this in the future. One thing that most people miss, you know, those today who want to say it's the Social Security number. If you got a Social Security number, you've taken the mark of the beast. But if you go back to those verses, there may be people today who, out of ignorance, who knows what reason, may have a Social Security number. But that doesn't mean that they're under the condemnation of having the number of the beast, if indeed that is even can be considered the mark of the beast or a mark of the beast. Because if you go back to those verses that deal with it, it says not only those who took the number of the beast, but it says and those who worship the beast. It's got to be both. You see, there may be people today who are under the bondage of the Social Security system, who may have a number, and I don't care what you do as far as the system is concerned, you always have a number once you've had a number. You can do anything you want, but they still see you as having the number. But having a number in and of itself, they may have you in the bondage of that number to some degree, but they still may not at the same time have your heart and your mind. You know, this kind of slavery is really exemplified probably best by the Apostle Paul. Much of the New Testament, freedom's greatest document, was written by Paul while bodily imprisoned. But they could not, as the New Testament certainly, his epistles certainly testify, they could not and did not imprison his mind or his spirit. Philippians is probably testifies to this best. It was indeed one of those epistles that are called the prison epistles that he wrote while in prison. And yet, if you go through the book of Philippians, just those four chapters, you'll find that he encourages, admonishes, and uses the word rejoicing or rejoice or joy 18 different times. I'll guarantee they only had his body. They didn't have his spirit in his heart. So there's forced slavery. Bodily enslaved, yet in mind and spirit free. Then there's also another kind of slavery. Voluntary or slavery by choice. That is, those who are enslaved in both body and mind or spirit. Paul addresses this kind of slavery in 2 Corinthians 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. If I could find my way in the Bible, I'd get there. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 20, it says, "For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, if he hits you in the face." The first part again, he says, "For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you." It's the same kind of thing I believe our American forefathers were talking about in the second paragraph of our Declaration of Independence. There in that paragraph it says, "Accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms of which they are accustomed." In other words, this type of people are content with their slavery, even abusive slavery, or cruel bondage. They're just content with it. The Amplified, listen how it puts this same passage in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 20. It says, For you endure it, if a man assumes control of your souls and makes slaves of you, or devours your substance, spends your money, and preys upon you, or deceives and takes advantage of you, or is arrogant and puts on an air, or strikes you in the face." I'd say that's a pretty good description, at least from the Amplified version, a pretty good description of the mindset of most Americans today. Why, they not only willingly put up with enslavement, they keep going back for more and more. They keep looking to and petitioning their captors, their masters, and their subjugators for more bondage. How do I know that? Well, it's not any different than it was in Egypt. How do I know that? I know that because they keep voting in more and more oppressive slave drivers. It just keeps getting worse. You know, Bush, as bad as he was, certainly doesn't compare to Clinton. And I'll guarantee if they get Clinton out of the way, Gore is going to be even worse. It's, again, maybe it would fulfill again Matthew 23's proselytes, who are twice the sons of hell. But why? Why would the oppressed slave keep going back for more? You know, our people today, I believe, are not much different from an abused wife. The abused wife suffers from thinking that first, the abuse is her fault, second, that she deserves it for one reason or another, and that third, there's nothing better than what she's already experiencing. And as long as the abusive husband can keep her thinking that way, enslaving her mind, she'll never attempt to free herself. Didn't Isaiah warn us in Isaiah 5 and verse 13? "Therefore my people go into," or continue in, "exile." King James says captivity, "for the lack of knowledge," lack of understanding, lack of truth. Yeshua was the one who said, "Truth sets you free." I'll guarantee truth for the abusive wife helps to set her free. It's our people who are the wife of this slave driver known as government today that needs truth, knowledge, and understanding so they can free themselves from the captivities they are in. The elders of the protocols of Zion understood even the power of the word freedom. Listen to what they said in Protocol 3, Article 20. Quote, "The word freedom brings out the communities of men to fight against every kind of force, against every kind of authority." Ellipsis. "For this reason, we, when we come into our kingdom, shall have to erase this word from the lexicon of life." End of quote. I believe they tried to do it, but obviously it's still a part of our vocabulary. But you know what's even better than that? Is if you can convince the slave that they're free. And isn't that the state again of most Americans today? I think it was an assurance store when I was on my route a few years ago when I first came to Nebraska. I remember this particular insurance agent being so proud of this which was on his wall. And so I read it. He kind of talked about it a little bit. I didn't really comment at the time too much about it. But I read it and I said, "I'd like a copy of that." He thought I was as impressed with it as he was. But I wanted it for a different reason. It's called "The Dumbest Person in the World." Here's how it goes. How dumb? Very dumb. It's the American who knocks what he's got. It's the American who knocks what he's got. Here's what he's got. A country of unbounded beauty, almost unlimited natural resources, a judicial system that is the envy of the rest of the world, food so plentiful overeating is a major problem, a press nobody can dominate, a ballot box nobody can stuff, churches of your choice, 100 million jobs, freedom to go anywhere you want with the planes, cars, and highways to get you there, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, public schools, and plentiful scholarships, opportunity to become a millionaire. Okay, complainer, what's your second choice? Go. Well, you know, I think that was probably titled very well, "The Dumbest Person in the World," the one who would hang it on the wall and be proud of it. Let's take a different perspective, or get a different perspective of what was stated in that. Here's how somebody else might look at it. This is called Are You Free? Dealing with some of the very same thoughts, here's how somebody else may look at it. Titled, Are You Free? Are you free when over 40% of your hard-earned money is stolen by fraud via income tax to support a central government bureaucracy gone mad? Are you free when you can't drive on highways or public streets without a driver's license and vehicle registration or be thrown in jail? Are you free when you must pay ransom to the insurance monopoly before you can drive your own vehicle on public streets or highways? Are you free when the nation's police are more of a threat to life, liberty, and property than the so-called common criminals? Are you free when you must ask the state for permission to marry? Are you free when you cannot practice quote-unquote free enterprise without being regulated, licensed, and taxed by the government? Are you free when you will be jailed for contempt for exercising constitutional rights without some corrupt, degenerate judge's permission? Are you free when you must buy freedom movement or underground publications to learn the truth because the controlled media prints only lying propaganda? Are you free when the state tells you when and where and how to build on your own property and even denies you the right to modify unless you ask permission first? Are you free when America has more political prisoners under lock and key than any other nation in the world? Are you free when government knows every financial transaction you make and your private banking records are made available to their prying eyes without your consent? Are you free when your president is more concerned about a one-world order than the sovereignty of the country he has sworn to protect? And are you free when everything you or your children will ever own is mortgaged to the world's bankers and a collectible on demand? And then it's answered, "No, dear fellow American, if you think this still is the land of the free, you are living in a dream world and still believe in fairy tales." Well, indeed, the man who hung that on his wall probably fits the latter. Still a man who believes in fairy tale that hasn't been awakened. You know, most Americans believe we're the freest nation on earth, while we stand today as the most regulated police state in the world. Matter of fact, it's gotten so bad on our college campuses, we even have thought police. That's how bad it's got. That's how bad it's becoming. There are educators across the land today who have lost their jobs simply because they stated something or thought something which was politically incorrect. Matter of fact, I know a 16-year-old. Matter of fact, he's right here in his audience, who in his high school was given detention simply because he stated to the teacher that God's plan for women was in the home. And Daniel, I believe it's correct too that there was a girl standing by that called you a male chauvinist pig, and she wasn't given detention at all. Well, that's where we are, this great land of the free and the brave. Let me ask you, what's the purpose of thought police? Have you ever thought about that? I'll guarantee you that's something the thought police don't want you to do either, just to think about the purpose of thought police. Well, the purpose of thought police is, of course, mind control or mental slavery, the ultimate in slavery. And if you can enslave the mind, who do you think is going to be a better slave? One who's a slave both in mind and body, or one who's a slave only in body? I'll guarantee you which one will make the better slave. You don't even have to control or watch over the one you've enslaved in their mind, especially if you've at the same time convinced them that indeed they're free. You know, as bad off as the Israelites were in the Egyptian bondage, it doesn't compare with the bondage today's Israelites here in America are facing and under. At least our forefathers recognized their slavery and were petitioning for deliverance. Whereas American Israelites are indeed praying for deliverance, all right, but they're petitioning the wrong God, the little G God, big G government, which enslaved them in the very beginning to begin with. Well, just as there are different types of slavery, there are also different types of freedom. There's three types of freedom that I want to deal with in the remainder of the message, what I call body, soul, and spirit freedoms. What I mean by the freedom of the body is individual or physical freedom, and this is the type of the freedom the patriot provides. Patriotism alone can never provide anything but physical freedom. Now, that might also include political freedom or economic freedom or something of that kind. Nevertheless, without soul and spirit freedom, even what physical freedom the patriot can provide will be short-lived. And that's why America is in the state she is today. Because the Constitution, the 18th century patriots provided or gave us, fell short of providing all that we needed. Remember, it is only where the Spirit of the Lord is that we'll find true liberty or true freedom. And anything short of that cannot be considered freedom or liberty, at least in its entirety. I've stated this before, but my goal as a preacher of the gospel of the kingdom is not a return to a constitutional form of government, and neither should it be yours as a Christian. My aim is the reestablishment of the kingdom of heaven here on earth, predicated on only the laws of God. You know, I don't find anywhere in the scriptures where it says that the law of liberty is the Constitution. I don't find anywhere that it's called the law of the land either, or the supreme law of the land. Keep in mind, if the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, as I stated in other messages, then he who created it is the supreme being or God. And it's we the people who put it together. It falls short. Now there's no question, no debate that a return to our former constitutional form of government would be heads and shoulders, however you say it, above and beyond what we currently have, or better than what we currently have. But it would only be a temporary fix. And that's what the patriots, the majority of the patriots today, don't understand. It would only be a temporary fix as it originally was. Indeed, it was good at first, in light of, not in comparison to what they had here in America already, actually, in many cases, but in comparison to what England was trying to do with them. But it was only temporary. You know, although not specifically addressing patriotism, I believe the Apostle Peter provides a pretty clear picture of what patriotism alone is or can provide. In 2 Peter 2 and verse 19 it says, promising them freedom. Isn't that what patriots today are doing across this land? Matter of fact, at the end of this, are we free? It says to contact your local patriot group if you really want true freedom. Well, they're promising freedom. And Peter says, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. That's a pretty good picture of patriotism, at least patriotism without Christ. In John 8 and verse 36, Yeshua said, if therefore the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. He didn't say free in theory. He said free indeed. Any patriot without Yeshua the Christ can provide only temporary freedoms. The second type of freedom is what I'll call soul freedom, or freedom from sin, or freedom of conscience. And granted, this is the most important freedom, yet it is the only freedom. It's all that modern or Judeo-Christianity offers. And then it's usually only a pseudo-freedom. Actually, only God can offer this kind of freedom. Turn to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews 9 and verse 14, it says, how much more will the blood of the Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Only through Yeshua and his atoning blood sacrifice can our consciences be liberated by God's forgiveness. Of course, the church is supposed to assist in pointing candidates in the right direction in order to contact the blood. And yet the majority do no such thing. Hebrews 9 tells us that it's the blood of Yeshua that cleanses our conscience. But what must be done to make contact with the blood that cleanses our conscience? Well, regretfully, most of the churches aren't going to tell you. 1 Peter 3:21 tells us, and it's one of those verses you'll very seldom hear from most pulpits today, because it says, in corresponding to that, baptism, when, of course, preceded by faith and repentance. It says, in corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Yeshua the Christ. So what soul freedom Judeo-Christianity is offering is, for the most part, for most of them, only a pseudo-freedom. It's indeed the minority in Christendom who are even correctly pointing the way to soul freedom. But even that minority seldom go beyond that kind of freedom. As a matter of fact, because of their other false doctrines like the rapture, false doctrines like the kingdom to come rather than being here now, false doctrines like eternity in heaven, they'll tell you that soul freedom is the only freedom that Christians should be concerning themselves with. This world is not my home attitude. And so it's only the soul freedom you need to concern yourselves with as a Christian. And yet, listen to Paul. In 1 Corinthians 7 and verses 21 and 22, he states these words. He says, were you called while a slave? He's talking about a slave. He says, were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Note, Paul wrote, if as a Christian you are in the state of physical enslavement, don't fret over it. But if you can free yourselves, by all means do so. That doesn't sound like what's being taught from the majority of pulpits today. Those who say, you know, don't worry about it if you're in slavery to your government today. Don't worry about it if you've got economic oppression. If you're politically, physically, economically in bondage, don't worry about it. You know, you're free in your heart. You're free of your sins. And again, even that's not probably been provided. What a difference. Paul didn't seem to think that way. Modern Christianity needs to take a lesson from this. Spiritual freedom, unquestionably, is most important. Nonetheless, God is interested in seeing us totally free. 1 Corinthians 7:23 very clearly says, "You are bought with a price. Therefore, do not become slaves of men." If you are a slave, do whatever you can to get from under the bondage. If you're not a slave, don't become a slave to men. In other words, if we are in bondage to men, it should be our goal as Christians to see ourselves totally free. Our only freedom of spirit promotes such understanding and provides such direction, whereas the shortage of the Spirit provides bondage and slavery. The abundance of the Spirit, you know, there's all these people out in the religious world today claiming to be have the abundance of the Spirit, to be filled with the Spirit, the charismatic and so many others. And yet what are they teaching at the same time with this abundance of Spirit that they claim that they have? Bondage, slavery, total submission to government authority, oppressive government antichrist authority. I don't call that the abundance of the Spirit. Shortage of the Spirit produces bondage and slavery, whereas the abundance of the Spirit generates freedom, freedom of body, soul, and spirit. Once again, 2 Corinthians 3:17, "Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Lord is, there is liberty." And John 8:36 again, that Yeshua said, "Therefore, if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed." Not just in theory, but indeed. God's interested in freedom completely. True Spirit-led Christians are interested in freedom for all free. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 23, Paul again said, "Now may the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely, and may your spirit, soul, and body be preserved complete without blame at the coming of our Lord Yeshua the Christ." And I'll guarantee if he wanted it preserved complete, he wanted them all free and freedom complete as well. The book of Jasher expounds, as I think probably all of you here know, upon what we have recorded in Genesis and a little bit of Exodus. In chapter 81, Jasher provides a more detailed account of what took place at the Red Sea. Listen, beginning with Jasher chapter 81, and verses 25 through 27. He says this, "And the children of Israel lifted up their eyes and beheld all the Egyptians pursuing them, and the children of Israel were greatly terrified at them. And the children of Israel cried to the Lord," much the same as we found in Exodus 14. Then verse 26, "And on account of the Egyptians, the children of Israel divided themselves into four divisions, and they were divided in their opinions, for they were afraid of the Egyptians, and Moses spoke to each of them." Now there were four divisions, but note that they were divided in their opinions, but all for the same reason, because of their fear of the Egyptians. Verse 27, it says, "The first division was of the children of Reuben, Simeon, and Issachar. And they resolved to cast themselves into the sea, for they were exceedingly afraid of the Egyptians." The first division viewed death better than slavery. The second division viewed slavery better than death. Verse 29 says, "And the second division was of the children of Zebulun, Benjamin, and Naphtali. And they resolved to go back to Egypt with the Egyptians." They were the better Egyptian than extinction group. The third division were the Patrick Henrys of the group. Verse 31, it says, "The third division was of the children of Judah and Joseph, and they resolved to go meet the Egyptians to fight with them." They were the ones who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And then the fourth division was, at first they didn't know quite where to put, how to categorize them, but I finally figured it out. The fourth division was the Judeo-Christian preachers, or at least the equivalent thereof. Because in verse 33 we find this, "And the fourth division was of the children of Levi," of the priesthood, "Gad and Asher, and they resolved to go into the midst of the Egyptians to confound them." I guess they just figured that they'd talk the Egyptians to death. Four different divisions, four different responses, yet all from the same reason. They all still had slave mentalities. As a result, rather than looking to their deliverer for deliverance, each and every one either looked to themselves or looked at their oppressors. I love Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2. fixing, where it says fixing your eyes on Yeshua, the creator and perfecter of our faith. Now, they didn't do that. They didn't fix their eyes on their deliverer, in spite of the fact of what they just seen happen, what they just been through. No, they fixed their eyes either on themselves or on their oppressors. And consequently, they reacted in all four instances with the slave mentality. Thank God they had a Moses who, like Yeshua, could claim, as found in Isaiah 61 in verses 1 and 2, "The Spirit of the Lord, Yahweh, is upon me, because Yahweh has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of Yahweh and the day of vengeance of our God." Thank God they had a Moses. At least there was one man who would look to the deliverer. And the one who would not only deliver, but even bring vengeance upon their captives. You know, let us also put on the mind of Christ today and shed the chains of slavery that indeed we have in this country, both physically and mentally. And I'll guarantee you, if we don't do it mentally as well, if we don't do it spiritually as well, we may someday be able to divide ourselves, to shed the chains of physical slavery. But I'll guarantee it's going to be short-lived. You know, Judah and Joseph may have been able to go in, and they may have, in and by their own power, they may have been so bolstered in their faith that they could have taken on the Egyptian horde that was there facing them at the Red Sea. But that liberty, in and of the flesh, that the arm of the flesh alone would have been only a limited, conditional liberty. We have got to be free in spirit, soul, and body, all together. Let us free ourselves, that through Yeshua we might free others indeed. Let me end with this poem by Thelon Polk called "He Only Wanted Freedom." And I think you've probably heard it before, but I think it's a good ending to this message. "He only wanted freedom. In a little country farmhouse outside of Lexington lived a Christian farmer with his wife, two daughters, and a son. A peaceful sort of gentleman who never raised his voice and only lost his temper when he felt he had no choice. He seldom lost his patience and never looked for fights until the fighting started over his God-given rights. He was a man of courage and love and faith and pride. Although others feared the English, he knew God was on our side. The bullies in the redcoats who thought they were so tough have pushed his neighbors to the brink. They'd finally had enough. He thought about his children and his darling precious wife. To him, his family's freedom meant more than his own life. He searched his soul and trusted God and listened to his heart. He may be only one man, but he had to do his part. He told his wife to hurry and bring his favorite gun. His daughters fetched the powder while he whispered to his son. Then he hugged his family and they said their last goodbyes and quickly grabbed his musket as tears welled in his eyes. The final words he spoke that day, as though his fate be known, were, 'By the grace of Yahweh, I will meet you at the throne.' Those with wisdom recognize the redcoats of today. Yet few of you have courage to stand in evil's way. And fewer still would trade their life for the priceless gift of freedom, but would rather wear their master's chains and lick the hands that feed them." May it be that we stand with the remnant that reach for freedom instead of being content with slavery. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.